Mixed Martial Arts Point of View podcast may not be suitable for all audiences. Viewer and listener discretion is advised. Purchase your tracks today.
The official weigh-ins and stare-downs for May 13th's UFC Fight Night in Jacksonville have just concluded. Middleweight Carl Robeson is the only fighter to miss weight. Otherwise, the card will proceed and we will weigh in on this Fight Night May 16th, UFC 249, and other MMA matters. Welcome to another episode of MMA POV Podcast. We can be found on social media at Wrestling POV Podcast on Facebook, at MMA POV Podcast on Instagram and Twitter, and the show can be heard on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, and iHeartRadio. Deontay, what's up, sir? How you feel?
Deontay, I'm here.
All right. Glad to hear it.
So far, so good. No complaints. I'm safe. I am healthy, relatively happy. So I truly have no complaints. How about you, sir?
Man, I'm doing well. Just taking it one day at a time and trying to do what I can to ride this wave, get through, and just making sure all my loved ones are well in the midst of everything that's going on.
Absolutely, man. I echo that sentiment, man. And I know we're going to get into this later on in the show, but I got to know, man, has the missus been giving you a hard time for one-upping you on the PP, on the points system, man? Has she been giving you a hard time?
Oh, most definitely. She's feeling herself. You know, she is a few points ahead of me, but it's cool. We're gonna, you know, get into that a little bit later on and dissect the card as a whole. But yeah, she's definitely feeling herself, and she says she's coming for you.
I'm coming for her, man. I take no prisoners, man. You know what I mean? Yes, I'm cut from the same cloth as Michael Jordan. No prisoners. I'm coming for her, man. But look, I definitely understand that the show got some major love from a major figure in the MMA world. Tell us about it.
Yes, sir, it did. So thanks to some connections as a result of my editor, good friend of mine, my bro, if you will, Rick Serrano III, who is also the co-host of our flagship show, Wrestling POV Podcast. He was somehow or another able to work some magic to get the one and only, the natural Randy Couture, to cut a promo for us. I mean, I know it's been a little over a week in which it was done, but I'm still on a high from that. Truly thankful, truly appreciative, man. And you know, it just speaks volumes on what it is we're trying to do. To get that from him 3 episodes in, truly a blessing, man. Truly a blessing.
I mean, you're talking about an MMA Hall of Famer.
Yes, sir.
Talking about an action movie star.
Preach.
We're talking about somebody who has now transitioned into being an MMA trainer, analyst. I mean, we're talking about in the world of MMA, to understand how important he is, you probably would have to go into boxing and say, this is somebody who is as much respected in MMA as, say, one of the great heavyweights is in boxing. So, I mean, this is big. This is major. This is like 4 shows in. I mean, come on, man. What can you? That's huge. That's huge.
It really is, and I cannot agree with you more. And it's funny that you made a comparison to a household name in the world of boxing, if you will, because we are going to discuss one later on in the show. And of course, when I think of Randy Couture, I think of wrestling. Mm. And so with that being said, I have a timeline, if you will, that involves one of UFC's greatest wrestlers and a potential opponent who we may not see pair up anytime soon. You mind if I get into that a little bit?
Educate the people, sir.
Okay, most definitely. Count it done. So, the timeline involves Khabib Nurmagomedov, who is the current UFC lightweight champion, and Tony Ferguson, who, outside of Khabib, was considered the best lightweight in UFC and all of MMA. December 2015, Khabib suffered a rib injury. April 2016, Ferguson suffered a lung injury, and he had to pull out. March 2017, Khabib suffered an illness as a result of a weight cut gone wrong. And probably the most bizarre instance of them all, April 2018, where it was the conclusion of the UFC 223 pre fight press conference. And Tony got up from the table at the conclusion of the conference, and he tripped over an audio cord. As a result, tore his LCL and was unable to fight. Talk about bizarre.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's insane. An audio cord? That's insane. First of all, there should be no audio cords ever again. Everything should be wireless. But the fact that he tripped over an audio cord and he wasn't able to fight, and the other incidents that you just named, is just so bizarre and so crazy. It kind of makes you wonder if the fight is ever meant to be, or if the universe is lined up in some cosmic way against it ever happening, right? Some unexplainable force is fighting those two actually coming together in the octagon, which is crazy, but that's how it seems, right?
Indeed it does. Indeed it does. Moving right along, there is March 2020, an instance or an incident that is beyond all of our control, that being the pandemic of COVID-19. So because of COVID-19, international borders were shut down. But prior to that, what happened was Dana White, president of UFC, had told Khabib that they were 99.9% sure that the fight would take place in Abu Dhabi. So in preparation, Khabib flew to Abu Dhabi, was rejected at the border. And so as a result, since he was in the same continent, he went back to his home country of Russia, Dagestan, to be exact. And so he was with his family, and then he tried to return to the States for the original UFC 249. And of course, he wasn't allowed to due to the travel restrictions. Crazy instance. Crazy instance. Then finally, of course, the reason why this fight isn't going to happen as soon as we want it to. Justin the Highlight Gaethje. Because of what he did to Tony Ferguson, we shouldn't expect to see those two, which once upon a time came together to be the most anticipated fight in UFC history, at least not immediately. With that being said, man, what is your take on this whole instance? And furthermore, do you think this fight ever will happen? And will it carry the same sizzle that it did prior to Gaethje derailing everybody's plans?
I think it depends on how things shake up between Gaethje and Khabib moving forward in the future. So I also think it depends on where Conor weighs in on this too, or where UFC weighs in on this in regards to Conor in that division. So it depends on if Gaethje fights Khabib and he gets destroyed by Khabib, then the only other logical fight for Khabib would be Tony or Conor again. If he goes in there and he beats Khabib, then I could see that being a setup for a Khabib-Tony fight, another setup for a lead into a Khabib-Tony fight and Gaethje fighting Conor. Because of what Gaethje was able to accomplish against Tony and having beat Khabib, there's only one other challenge out there for him at that level, which would be Conor. So that's how I see it shaping up. Kind of reminds me of all the incidents that you laid out and the fact that the fight hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. And the anticipation, the buildup is so grand. It kind of reminds me of the anticipation and buildup for the Hagler versus Leonard fight, where
yes,
Hagler was just kind of like, he was seen as a no-nonsense roughneck type of fighter, right? He was a guy that people avoided because of the fact that he wasn't a fighter that would let you go in there and not work to beat him. He was like on a war path, right? His mentality was warlike when he stepped into the ring, and he was a rough rider for sure. So Leonard at the time had a lot of great victories, was already solidified as one of the best out there. Hagler was on the come up, but Hagler was like a blue collar guy. So it was like he didn't have all the fame and the glory and all the money behind him, all the persona. He didn't have all the endorsements. He wasn't the guy, you know what I mean, in 7-Up commercials. He wasn't the guy selling cars and clothes, and he doesn't have the matinee movie star idol looks like Leonard. So he wasn't he was seen as the guy who was just a rough guy. Nobody really wanted to fight. But the fact that he was whooping everybody's ass made people say, man, Leonard got to see this dude. But as a result, you know, they tried to put together the fight over many years. Leonard got injured, detached retina. He ended up retiring before giving Marvin the fight. While he retired for a few years, Marvin Hagler was still climbing the ranks, still one of the best out there. And he became eventually the best out there in that division. As a result, Leonard came out of retirement, ended up fighting Marvin, and that's the fight we got. So that anticipation built up for years, man. So it's kind of like similar to that between Tony and Khabib. But, you know, Khabib is my guy, man. I got respect for anybody that wrestles a bear when they're a kid. Like, that's insane. That's like pure insanity, dude. Bro, I hated playing Mike Tyson's punch out because I couldn't beat Mike Tyson. This dude was wrestling a bear. Like, I was on a video game with a controller pressing two buttons. He was actually wrestling an animal that can kill you if they so desire, which is like, are you serious? And they were laughing. They used to tape their laughing at it. It was entertaining for them. That's a different upbringing, man. That's a different upbringing, man. Growing up where I grew up, man, I didn't even, you know what I mean, want to go to the playground if I had some whack shoes on or something. But these dudes, they wrestling bears. That's a different life.
Okay, so when it comes to Khabib and Tony, man, I must say, I, more than anything, want to see this fight happen. But I just have a feeling that ultimately what's going to happen is that it may come to a place where we may not. My hope is that, rather, it doesn't come to a place where we see them fight at the tail end of their careers and their shells of their former selves.
Yeah, that would be a letdown, man. That would be like watching Floyd fight Pacquiao again. You know what I mean? Absolutely. After they've reached their pinnacle of prime, and now they're on a decline, and then they fight each other, and it's just like, I don't
know. Yeah, man, I cannot agree with you more. So what we're going to do now is actually move forward with the show and get into our MMA hot topic of the week. UFC 249 is officially in the books, with everything connected to this card, from the rescheduling and alterations to Team Jacare testing positive for COVID-19, the eve of, to fight night itself. What are your thoughts on the company's 249th pay-per-view? I'm going to start out and then I'll let you come in behind me and, you know, bring it on home in this regard. Yes, so, sir. According to UFC Vice President of Operations and Production, Craig Bassari, the following changes were supposed to be evident during the pay-per-view. One, of course, the obvious, an empty arena. Two, members of the broadcast team, John Anik, Joe Rogan, and Daniel Cormier, will be seated at separate tables. Next, post-fight interviews will not take place in the octagon. Instead, winners will be escorted to an isolated room wearing a sanitized headset, and Joe Rogan will interview the winner remotely from his designated ringside location. Details were being worked on about the disinfecting of the cage in between fights. Now, cosmetically, this indeed was different. Just so you know, in reference to the post-fight interviews, they started out doing them in the way that they were supposed to do, you know, with the whole social distancing being put into play. But as a result of time consumption, they decided to go with the traditional post-fight interview format, which is Joe Rogan interviewing the winners inside of the octagon. With the empty arena being what it was, you could hear things more clearly. You could hear the sounds of the strikes. You can hear the coaching from ringside. You even could hear, according to Greg Hardy, suggestions and analysis from the analyst tables at ringside as well, because he said he heard something that DC said. I want to say it was maybe in reference to the countering of DeCastro's kicks. I'm not quite sure, but I want to say it was along those lines. But in so many words, he said that he was able to hear Cormier's words, implement them into, you know, his approach, which played a role in him winning the fight. The card in itself, I thought, was an excellent comeback for the UFC, considering everything that was going on and all the drama attached to it. They came back and gave us an amazing card. And as a matter of fact, it should be, in my opinion, in consideration for card of the year, MMA card of the year. And yes, we will eventually have, you know, year in awards to highlight such things as the card of the year, fight of the year, things of that nature. But overall, I think things went very well. And I must say, you know, hats off to UFC in the midst of everything that went on. What are your thoughts on the matter?
I think business wise, it was a huge success because of the fact that, at this time, there is nothing that it's in competition with as far as sports goes, whether that's combat sports or whether that's team sports or even individual sports, because right now it's the only sport that's being played in terms of publicly aired and all of those things, high profileness of it. So business wise, it was a success, of course. Right. So it gave the people who love mixed martial arts what they wanted their fix. I also echo your sentiment that an empty arena allowed for the, the advice of the corners and the sounds of the two combatants going at it enhanced the experience for the viewer. Certainly there are a lot of sounds connected to emotion in sports that people who love sports experience and never forget, right? You never forget the sound that a ball makes when it makes contact with the wooden bat and the hitter knocks it out the park. You never forget that sound. You never forget that sound when a linebacker's coming off the edge and the quarterback is just sitting there like a deer, and the linebacker is like a bullet shot out of a gun. It's like, boom, that impact. You never forget that. You never forget the sound of that sweet backhand coming off the racket from somebody like Roger Federer, Andre Agassi, just the tennis greats that are out there, Arthur Ashe. So you never forget the sound of somebody, you know, essentially hitting someone else with a 1-2, a great combo, or say somebody like a Mike Tyson in the ring who punched with as much velocity and viciousness that he did. Yeah. The sound that his fist made when they connected to somebody's head or even to the body, right? So we get those same sensations from this event. You can hear people getting kicked, people getting punched, you know, people getting taken to the ground, the wrestling, the submission, all of those things, sights and sounds. So from that perspective, it was a success. It gave the MMA viewer what they wanted, that fixed business-wise. It had no other competition, so I'm sure it was successful. And so from that perspective, from the purely sports and economic business perspective, it was a huge success, but it came with some drawbacks, definitely, I think. What do you think about the drawbacks? Do you think there were any?
I do think there was some drawback, and mainly it revolved around the story of Jacare Sosa and two of his cornermen who tested positive the eve of the card. So when the news broke, me as a fan, I was concerned. Many other fans were concerned, but UFC pretty much had an approach, if you will, or mentality that said, you know, hey, this is why we have these preventative measures in place to let us know who does have the virus, and, you know, and it will help us to you know, handle the matter and try to prevent the spread of it as much as possible. I mean, there's nothing, unfortunately, we could do to actually stop the virus from spreading. But if we could get someone who has been infected in an isolated environment, then we will do that and do the best that we can to keep the virus from spreading. With that being said, my hope is that moving forward, we don't hear of any more cases in which fighters or hotel staff or the ViStar Veterans Memorial Stadium staff has, you know, contracted the virus. Well, actually, we could scratch the stadium only because, or the arena only because Jacare didn't even make it there. But the hope moving forward is that no fighter, no UFC staff, or no hotel staff members contracted the virus as a result of Jacare's presence.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that,
yeah.
I mean, you know my opinion, man. You know what I said the last few shows. Like, it's, I come down on the side that, you know, an event like this should never have happened. It put a lot of people at risk unnecessarily. We had some positive tests. We may see news that more tested positive as a result of the event taking place. And then two, the just something for people to think about. You have to think about the politics of it. Like, how was it that Florida was able to make WWE wrestling and MMA fighting essential services or essential businesses that needed to be open? Essential meaning we needed to exist, to live, to survive, right? So how is it that Florida, the governor of Florida, made those services essential? How is it that the UFC were able to get a hold of so many tests that anybody who was a part of that event, from the fighters and the fighters' camps to the hotel staff and to the people that worked around that event, were able to get tested on a daily basis if they so needed, right? So how is that possible when we have less than 3% of the country at this point that has been tested for this virus, right? And then you look at the fact that the relationship that White has, Dana White, that is, that White has with Trump, that DeSantis has with Trump, that the McMahons have with Trump, Linda McMahon once being in Trump's cabinet, a large political donation being filtered from a group that is headed by the McMahons, filtering a large political donation to the coffers of DeSantis. And so we see all of those political connections at work. And I don't want to go too deep into that, but I think that definitely played a large role in the fact that that event was able to take place and be labeled as essential and was able to take place in Florida. And then we have another event in the next couple of days that's also going to take place in Florida as well. Same spot. So the politics of it are definitely something that that's something that's interesting and something that played a big role. But I come down on the side of it. It should not have happened. The event coming up should not happen either. But of course, my opinion may be in the minority. But business wise, it was a success. So,
all right, understood, man. Definitely appreciate your insight on that. Well, whatever side it is you sit on, whether the event should have happened or shouldn't have happened, UFC 249 mm-hmm. did take place. And with that being said, it's about that time for us to go into our Ground and Pound segment of the show, where we will dive into UFC 249 as well as other matters that have taken place in the world of mixed martial arts. But before we actually go into the event itself, we first want to congratulate Mr. Danny Hodgson, who won the UFC 249 MMA POV pay-per-view points game. He not only won the individual event, but right now he stands at the top of the mountain of the overall MMA POV points game standings at 18 points. Following him is Cree Crahill, who closed the night out with 15 points. We then have a three-way tie with Melissa Hoffman, Rick Serrano III, and you, sir. And then bringing up the rear tie for six is myself and Clay Cummings. And then bringing up the rear is, we're tied at 9 points. And then Tony Diaz is bringing up the rear at 8 points. You said you're coming for Melissa.
I'm coming for Melissa, man.
I would definitely let her know.
Just absolutely. Let her know, man.
Absolutely. I will get the word to her, and I'm sure. I got you. Oh, she'll welcome the challenge.
Return of the Jedi, man. Return of the Jedi. All I'm saying.
All right. In terms of the card in itself, let's begin with the main event. Justin Gaethje, as mentioned earlier, defeated Tony Ferguson via TKO as a result of referee stoppage 3 minutes, 39 seconds into the final round to become UFC's men's interim lightweight champion, all but ensuring himself a date with Khabib Nurmagomedov, unless some unforeseen circumstances come into play, for the undisputed lightweight crown. Gaethje also won two bonuses, that being Fight of the Night and a performance bonus. Let me start by saying this first. Tony Ferguson is an absolute dog. It's clear to me that his chin is not made of flesh and bone. It's made of granite. He took some shots from Gaethje that most men would not be able to withstand. He even landed an uppercut in the second round that seemed to shift momentum, the momentum of the fight in his favor. Justin Gaethje was able to recover from that. He was able to take heed to some excellent advice from his coach, Trevor Whitman, where he basically told him to not exert so much energy in every punch that he throws, but to, you know, preserve himself. He did that, still was able to land some significant shots on Tony throughout the course of the bout. And then when it was all said and done, he hit Tony with a left hook that was so severe. Mind you, Tony had already been staggered a couple of times throughout the fight. But with the final blow of the fight, when he hit Tony, not only did Tony stagger, but he shook his head in like a no type gesture. So we don't know if it was him actually saying no, he can't take anymore, or was he trying to shake it off and be a soldier and continue throughout the fight. But anyway, you slice it. Referee Herb Dean figured enough was enough. He stepped in and called in a night. And we now look at a new interim lightweight champion in Justin Gaethje. What are your thoughts on this fight, Deontay? Truly, it was amazing. And for me, it's definitely a fight of the year candidate.
Man, that hook and his head shaking. I thought he was going to try to order some French fries or something. I don't even know if he knew where he was at. So that was smart to end the fight there, man. Bruh, a referee can see. A referee that close, a ref can see when they look in your face whether or not you should take any more punishment. Because you know, a combatant, man, is a combatant in there. They got to be seen from theyself. So the ref did the right thing. I mean, you save the guy from himself and give him an opportunity to fight another day. I'm like you, man. The type of shots he took were just, you know, you gotta admire when you watch somebody take those type of shots and still be able to, you gotta admire their willpower, their desire. So I'm with you, man. I'll be honest with you, man. I wouldn't mind seeing that fight again.
I agree wholeheartedly. I know a lot.
Gotcha. I was just saying, I wouldn't mind completely. Seeing a rematch of that.
I wouldn't mind seeing that rematch either. I know a lot of people will feel otherwise considering how dominant Gaethje was. But again, looking at Tony and his history, how much of a warrior he is, I would not mind seeing that one again. I just don't know if it'll happen only because it was so dominant. UFC usually doesn't book rematches and fights where, you know, it was lopsided, unless Tony goes on some sort of run.
Man, gotta respect the fighters who realize that they gave everything they had, but
right,
it just wasn't good enough that particular match. So I love when fighters give Gaethje, you know, the other fighter
Tony definitely
that type
gave
of respect and credit.
Gaethje his due, that. And it was well deserved. Now we're gonna move on to the co-main event, Henry Cejudo. Defeated Dominic Cruz via TKO as a result of a referee stoppage with 2 seconds left in the second round for the men's bantamweight championship. And he was able to retain his championship. So Dominic Cruz, as I expected, had a brand of footwork to the likes of which Cejudo has never seen before. Cejudo, however, was patient. You know, he didn't lose composure and he continued fighting his fight. He did exactly what his coaches and training partners have trained him to do. And it was a back and forth fight, but you know, Cejudo was winning the fight. He definitely handled himself well against that footwork. In the In the waning moments of the bout, Cruz went for an uppercut and he missed. And as a result, for whatever reason, he ducked his head downward. And that was an opportune time for Cejudo to hit him with a knee and then follow up with punches to close on out. Now, I will say this, that the referee, I thought, stopped the fight prematurely because it looked like Dominic was in the process of standing up. But many people feel as though he wasn't defending himself in an intelligent manner because his face was down, even though it looked like he was trying to get up. But it is what it is, and Cejudo remains the bantamweight champion. And he announces retirement after the fact. I don't think he's going to retire, though. How do you feel?
Yeah, I agree with the ref, man. I generally, when it comes to mixed martial arts, because of the fact that there's more than just punches being thrown, I generally tend to side with the refs when they stop something. I mean, a punch is one thing, but a knee, a kick, the possibility that somebody is still hurt from a knee or a kick and not willing to just give up, and could be hurt severely if they take another blow. You know, I mean, a kick to the head or a knee to anywhere is so different than a punch, man. And I mean, it's the brutality of it tends for me, the brutality of it always to me, it tends for me, to side with the referees because it's just such a brutal, brutal sport. Like, I don't even care about how much time is left or whatever. It's just the sheer brutality of it, man. And it only takes a moment for somebody to kick you, knee you, elbow you, or even punch you in a way that could render you permanently damaged. So, or even dead. So, yeah, I always side with the refs and when they stop those, for the most part, unless it's something like so egregious that, you know, even Stevie Wonder conceded that shouldn't have been stopped.
So I noticed on a few occasions you used the word brutal. So that is an apropos description of these next two results. Francis Ngannou ended Jairzinho Rozenstruik's night in 20 seconds. As a result of a knockout, 20 seconds in an opening round. Ngannou won a performance bonus himself as a result of the fast knockout. I mean, these two, they exchange hands. The total strike count was 11. 6 for Ngannou, 5 for Rozenstruik. And for a fight to have that low of a strike count total goes to show you how quick the fight was. I mean, the shot that he hit Rozenstruik with, I mean, it unceremoniously set him down, and Ngannou just stood in front of him, leaned towards him, and just continued to unleash bombs until the ref said enough is enough. You said that these two fight with cinder blocks on their hands. Yeah, cinder blocks. And it was clear that Ngannou's cinder blocks were bigger and heavier than those of Rozenstruik's. What were your thoughts on this fight?
When I saw the knockout, I was like, wow, one dude should not have even been in the ring with the other dude. But it reminded me, if you go back into the archives of, early Mike Tyson fights, 1980s Mike Tyson, before the 90s, or even some early 90s Mike Tyson fights, but Mike Tyson, when he was kind of on his rise, when people were like, yo, I'm not fighting this guy is insane. He's that good. Mike Tyson versus Joe Frazier's son, Marvis Frazier. To Marvis Frazier's credit, he actually tried to mix it up with Tyson, but man, he got caught in the corner. I can't remember if it was one of those hooks or maybe it was that uppercut. But when he, like, it was a part of a combination that Tyson was throwing. But when Tyson connected with that one punch, all you see is Marvis Frazier's knee just give out and his body just crumble to the canvas against the ropes. But Tyson was already in the midst of a combination. So when Tyson hit him, his body crumbled, but Tyson was still throwing punches. And it was just like that one punch landed. So I think the same thing happened in this fight. It was that he got caught with something. I couldn't even tell what he got caught with because the barrage happened so quickly that he just kind of was falling backwards and crumbled. And it was just like, wow, like you could tell one person was ready for the fight. The other person just clearly didn't have the correct strategy for who they were fighting. I mean, that was kind of clear, man. If a guy with that type of power and you can't take those shots, you should not try to mix it up with that person. That's the point, I guess. It was brutal. It was entertaining, though.
The next bout also ended in a surprisingly brutal fashion. Calvin Kattar defeated Jeremy Stephens by way of TKO with elbows and mounted strikes 2 minutes, 49 seconds into round two. So off the bat, my expectation was for this fight to go to the decision. I mean, I knew that Jeremy Stephens, a.k.a. Little Heathen, would go for the knockout. I mean, that's what he does. Calvin Kattar, I just thought, would be the type of fighter that would stick and move, chip away at him, you know, with strikes, making himself a moving target and, you know, winning a points game. But Calvin Kattar showed us all that he, too, has knockout power. And the elbow that he threw when it landed, I mean, it was squeamish because he caused Stevens to bleed, if you will. He had him leaking immediately, and then he followed up with mounted strikes, and the referee pretty much said, you know what, your night is over with. I was pleasantly surprised with Kattar's knockout power. Yeah, yeah.
He earned my respect, that's for sure. No question. I don't disagree with anything you said. I don't disagree with anything you said. This conversation gonna be short. Absolutely, you're absolutely right.
I mean, pleasantly surprised.
You're absolutely right.
All right, moving forward. Your cousin Greg Hardy, your cousin. Yeah.
Oh man.
He defeated Yoga De Castro via unanimous decision. The two came out of the gates throwing bombs. De Castro was deceptively fast. I mean, he was moving around and throwing leg kicks, and you know, his mobility, you know, took me by surprise. There was a moment in the fight, however, where apparently Hardy said he heard Daniel Cormier say something along the lines of, you know, watch out for the kicks and make adjustments so that you're not vulnerable to De Castro's kicks. He made said adjustments, implemented them into his strategy, and will go on to win the fight. But I will say this, unfortunately, the fight started out on fire. I mean, there were sequences and pockets of exchanges where I was absolutely shocked that the two survived those exchanges. But after a while, the fight fizzled out. You know, wasn't as exciting as the opening round, but still, Hardy got the job done. So what is your take on Greg Hardy and his ability to get the win over De Castro?
The adjustment that Greg Hardy made was amazing. It had to do with, I believe, defending his kicks in some way. It was an adjustment to the way he was defending the kicks that he was receiving. And I think that's what kind of put him over the top. But I'm also impressed by the amount of skill that Greg Hardy has acquired as an MMA fighter, because we must remember his primary sport was not mixed martial arts. He's not a person who came to this sport having a storied history of amateur MMA or any MMA competition. He came to the sport from football. So he's not in any way, shape, or form a finished product. And the amount of skill that he's been able to acquire in the short time that he's been involved in the sport, coming off of a career as a football player and a pretty good football player. I mean, he wasn't a terrible player. I mean, he was actually a pretty good player. Unfortunately, you know, his run-ins with a former girlfriend and the fallout from that and ended his career. I'm impressed with the way he's picked up the sport, because fighting, whether it's boxing or MMA, most of those guys have been doing it for years. It takes like decades to master something, right? Something so brutal. And he's been able to put together an impressive early start to his MMA career. So I am kind of looking forward to what the future has in store for him. I mean, he could be one of those guys that presents a problem in the heavyweight division. So we'll see if he continues to grow and continues to be one of, or can mature into one of the best heavyweights in MMA. But I'm kind of curious to see what happens with him. I mean, I definitely think he has the athletic ability. We know he has the proper amount of crazy to be able to to be a great MMA fighter. But we'll see, man. I'm definitely curious to see what his career holds, man. And I'm watching him, and I'm kind of encouraged by the way he's picked up the sport so quickly.
the level of crazy, amazing, I like actually. That. In addition to that, let me say this about Greg Hardy. He has the benefit of training with one of the best teams in all of mixed martial arts, American Top Team, which is led by coaches Dan Lambert and Mike Brand, who is a former World Extreme cage fighting champion himself. He is surrounded by such talent as women's bantamweight and featherweight champion Amanda Nunes, the UFC BMF champion Jorge Masvidal. Many people may not like this next name, but Game has to recognize Game, Colby Covington, and Dustin Poirier. Like, he is surrounded by talent, and he can only help get better. He can only get better. He can't help but to get better. Excuse me. In addition, so I'm not sure if you watch the reality series that comes on TNT, Shaq Life. But it basically follows Shaq and, you know, chronicles his life after, you know, pro basketball and him being a, you know, I guess media mogul of sorts and being a spokesman for a variety of brands. So when Shaq has off time, Shaq, because he lives in Orlando, he likes to go to American Top Team and spar. And he actually has been practicing MMA for some time now. I mean, he's still an amateur. But he still practices the sport, and he's trying to, you know, polish his craft, if you will, polish his skills. So on one specific episode, I believe that will be 2 weeks ago, he had a sparring session with Greg Hardy. Now, mind you, Greg Hardy is 6'4", 265. Shaq is 7'2", 370 pounds. And for Greg to...
Shaq is 370. Shaq 470. Shaq. Shaq and Holly,
well, I mean, that's what the tale of the take totals on that specific episode. But whether Shaq is 370 pounds or 470 pounds, the fact of the matter is, one, Shaq is doing quite well for himself considering he is an amateur. Two, and most importantly, for Greg Hardy to be able to, you know, roll around and grapple with someone 100 plus pounds over him was quite impressive, and I actually wanted to see some sort of grappling in this fight with this Castro. Maybe we'll see it moving forward, but I will say this. If he continues rolling around with Shaq, he can only get stronger, and it'll only make him more dangerous. But yeah, Shaq is definitely getting in repetitions as a mixed martial artist and training and grappling.
Man,
and
nobody should be teaching Shaq how to fight either, man. Shaq is too big, man. He's, come on, man. 7'2", man. God. And you want to fight, man? First of all, ain't nobody trying to fight you. Ain't nobody in their right mind walking to Shaq to start a problem. Nobody. I don't think anybody. Come on, man. Nobody on the street sees somebody Shaq's size and say, man, I got a problem with that dude, and I'm going to handle it right now. No, you not. No, you not. You just want to. Right, you're going to sit on the curb and say you got a problem with him, but you ain't stepping to Shaq, whether he can fight or not. A size 22 foot? Come on, bro. Yeah. Upside your head? Man, nah. Nah, you don't want that work.
I cannot agree with you more, man. I cannot agree with you more. All right, so our next bout is Anthony Pettis and Donald Cerrone. So, first and foremost, Cowboy showed up to fight, man. This was not Donald Cerrone. This indeed was Cowboy. Anthony Pettis, however, got the decision, unanimous decision to be exact. The two were definitely striking. They definitely put on the type of fight that made these two household names in this sport. Pettis outstruck Cowboy 81-62. However, Cowboy landed two takedowns, and many, including myself, felt like Cowboy should have won this fight. There was a fight in the prelim, the opening bout to be exact. had the same dynamic with, you know, a couple of alterations where Sam Alvey had outstruck Ryan Spann 107-52. However, Spann landed 2 takedowns and the judges gave him the decision. And so for the life of me, I was baffled, especially considering the striking distance, you know, especially considering the striking distance, you know, the difference, should I say, with the striking between the two. It was baffling because the difference was smaller in the Cowboy Pettis fight than it was the Spann Alvey fight. However, Spann is awarded a win, Cowboy isn't. And it just speaks to the inconsistency with the judging in MMA that severely needs to be addressed and fixed once and for all. What do you think?
Cowboy acquitted himself very well.
Indeed.
Coming off of a fight where he clearly wasn't up to the challenge that night, he acquitted himself very well. I think based on my previous comments, I said that, you know, if he looks like he's not able to be any different than he was when he fought Connor, he probably should hang it up. I think he has proven that, or he proved rather that night, UFC 249, that he is still in the game. He is still capable. He is not ready to retire. And his effort, I think, acquitted him nicely. So, yes, I would love to see him fight again. I would love to see him get better, because a focused Indeed. Cowboy is going to give you a very good, very good matchup. Right, you're not going to run him. So that's my takeaway from it.
All right, then finally we have, as far as the main card or the points game is concerned, we have Alexei Oleinik defeating Fabricio Werdum via unanimous decision. Aside from the 2 takedowns and a few failed submission attempts, Werdum looked overwhelmed. He didn't throw with the ferocity he once did during his UFC run from 2012 to 2015 before losing his title to current champion Stipe Miocic. It was clear to me that PED Werdum is a different animal from non-PED Werdum. Oleinik, on the other hand, was relentless with his strikes. He had a clear-cut advantage in that department. Even when the fight went to the ground, Oleinik proved to be well-versed there defensively, as he was able to ward off every submission attempt of Werdum. How do you feel about Werdum versus Oleinik and his comeback?
Please. Real quick, I'm going to just jump on my soapbox on just real quick, like a quick 20, 30 second soapbox. When people who engage in combat sports take performance enhancing drugs and walk into an octagon or a boxing ring, and you know that you are a cheater at a sport where you can conceivably permanently harm your opponent or even kill them, I have zero respect for you, because the other person is training hard to beat a human being who they believe is training hard to beat them. Now, there are several supplements, several dietary things you can do to make your performance improved and optimum without having to take illegal drugs as outlined by the governing body of the particular combat sport that you're engaging in. So when you take those drugs and you look awesome, you look great. I mean, you just look like you fitting to climb the ladder. And then when we find out you took them and now you can no longer take them, and you go out there and you look like a tomato can version of who you used to be, I have zero respect for you. None. The correlation to me between somebody who got caught taking PEDs, who was once seen as a good fighter with good skills, and when we find out they're taking PEDs, then they come back out and they look like trash. Andre yes. Berto. Andre Berto is a boxer. Early Andre Berto, if you go back and look at early Andre Berto fights, I mean, this guy... you had some people, ringside commentators, who was comparing him to a smaller version of Mike Tyson in the way that he would walk opponents down, the way that he would throw just menacing shots and bunches, and his so-called power. And we find out Andre Berto was on PEDs. So after you take away the PEDs from Andre Berto, all of a sudden he can't take a punch the way he used to. All of a sudden his speed ain't what it used to. His power certainly was nowhere what it was when he was on the PEDs. And as a result, he's fallen to relative obscurity in the sport of boxing. Nobody talks about Andre Berto anymore. So to me, man, I just have, that's my soapbox, man. I got no respect for PED users in combat sports or boxing, man, because that's, you're playing with someone else's health and life. And I just, I have no respect
argue.
For that.
I cannot argue with you, and I respect and appreciate your passion as it relates to that matter. Let me just do some quick hits on the prelims. We have Carla Esparza, who defeated Michelle Waterson via split decision. Waterson opened up the bout with a series of punch-to-kick combos. Esparza was able to adjust. She landed a takedown, and she kept the pressure and forward movement and strikes going and pretty much secured herself the win. We already talked about the opening fight of the prelims, that being Ryan Spann and Sam Alvey. Your boy, Bryce Mitchell, a.k.a. Thug Nasty, was able to get a win over Charles Rosa by way of unanimous decision. I mean, this guy put on an absolute grappling clinic. I mean, he was determined, in my opinion, to get off as many submissions as possible in a 15-minute time span. And even when he couldn't get a submission, this guy was able to land strikes while on the ground. I mean, he flat out overwhelmed Rosa. I'm dead serious. I mean, he flat out overwhelmed him. And for Rosa to be able to survive that grappling onslaught to even hear or witness the judges render a decision is remarkable, excuse me, because most men would have quit. Most men would have tapped out. And Mitchell even secured a few triangle chokes, if I'm not mistaken. But this guy, Rosa, was able to bite the bullet and survive until the end of the round, or until the ref would, you know, call for a break. But yeah, it was incredible for him to survive the way he did. And then finally, you had Vincent Luque against Nico Price, who won by way of TKO, Dr. Stoppage, 3 minutes 37 seconds into the third round. Aside from one takedown from Price, it was an absolute striking clinic. The clinic would have come to an abrupt end where Luque would hit Price with a left hook that would swell his eye completely shut. It was nasty. What would you think? What did you think about that? And by the way, let me note that the eye was so severely damaged that in addition to it swelling completely shut, there was a cut above his eye and then two cuts below his eye. So yeah, what is your take on that? And what were your thoughts when that eye swelled shut the way it did?
You gonna laugh at this, but this is exactly what I thought about at the time. Do you remember, I'm trying to think of the guy's name. Oh, okay. Do you remember Mitch Blood Green?
Yes, I remember the name quite well.
Getting into a confrontation with a young Mike Tyson on the street. on the street. And then he had confronted Mike Tyson while Mike Tyson, I think, was coming out of, was it Dapper Dan's store at the time?
I want to say
it was Dapper Dan's store at the time. He was coming out of Dapper Dan's store. Mitch Green, Mitch Blood Green. That's important that I put the blood in there, because he actually was a pretty good boxer who had a pretty decent record, and he had like top five Jerry curls on the planet at the time. His Jerry curl was dope. He had a hang time on his Jerry curl. He was like the box version of the Jerry curl that you see on the actual box, like the person who had it, like my man from the Soul Glow ads. That was his Jerry curl, right? So this guy, Jerry curl, confronts Tyson on the street. I mean, we're talking about Tyson in the days where he was trained by Customato, the Tyson that was, you know, absolutely brutal. And I'm pretty sure I've actually met Mike Tyson before. and spent some time around him. One of his wives used to be one of the wives he used to be married to, I should say, was her godmother was a neighbor of my parents, and they had a cookout one time. He was there. It was like after he got out of prison, he was there. So I spent some time around him, and he's definitely not what you would think a guy of his profession would be like, in terms of like, you know, show offy, loud, rowdy. He was actually pretty chill and calm, and he was actually smaller than I thought he would be. But you could tell, I could tell when I shook his hand, like his hand, the size of his hand and the grip of his hand, I could just tell like he punches people for a living. So that eye made me think of Mitch Green confronting Tyson in New York when Tyson was young. And I'm pretty sure Tyson was like, yo, bro, come on, man. Like, I'm just chilling. We just doing our thing. We like, just move on, man. Just move on. I don't want to hurt you. You know what I'm saying? So I remember the press conference, Mitch Green, not press conference, but him giving comments to the press, Mitch Blood Green, with the swollen eye. And the eye was closed. You know what I'm saying? Like, the eye was closed completely. And he was calling Mike Tyson a punk. Like, I'm like, first of all, bro, you confronted somebody on the street that didn't even want to fight you. You got into the fight. He beat your ass so bad that your whole face, the side of your face where he punched you, is literally shut down. It's like one side of your face when you talk moves, and the other side of your face ain't moving at all because it's hurting. And you calling him a punk? You saying what you gonna do to him? Bro, look what he already did to you. That's what it made me think of, man. So I know that's a long explanation, but that's exactly what I thought of. That and the episode of Martin where he fought Tommy Hearns. And he called Tommy. What did he call Tommy? He said, I just got a call from Sugar. He called you the get hit man. That's what I thought of, man. That's crazy.
All right, well, speaking of jabs and name calling and things of that nature, we're going to get into our next item in the in this session of Ground and Pound.
Oh, man.
Conor McGregor. Conor McGregor in his Twitter tirade. So Conor McGregor yesterday, as in Monday, May 11th, he went on this Twitter tirade going at any and everybody, mainly the top four contenders in the lightweight division. He said he started by calling Khabib a disgrace to the division. He said that Dustin Poirier will be a repeat of what he did to him some years back, where he'll bounce his head off the canvas. He called Tony Ferguson a traitor because Tony is no longer with Conor's management team. And then he went on to say, as far as Justin Gaethje is concerned, that he will knock his teeth out and wear them as a necklace. And, I mean, I get you going at Dustin because you've beat Dustin already. I even get you going at Tony and Justin because you've never fought them before and you're confident in your skill set. But when I think of Khabib Nurmagomedov and I think about how Khabib waylaid and boat raced and mollywopped Conor and literally beat him from pillar to post and tossed him from one end of the octagon to the other. What in his right mind makes him think he could talk the trash to Khabib that he does, knowing what Khabib did to him back at UFC 249? Because for the life of me, I don't get it. I just don't.
Oh, he gonna sell the fight. He gonna sell the fight. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. So when I first saw the tweets, and just to let the people know, when you say yesterday, you're talking about Monday the 11th, right? We're recording this on the 12th. So just in case the people want to go back and look at Conor's tweets from May 11th, 2020, just scroll through the absolute garbage he was talking. But what he's doing is he's being a showman. He's selling the fight. He's giving people something to talk about, as exemplified by the fact that we're talking about it now. I mean, we discussed UFC 249. and all of those things. But we're still talking about Connor, and Connor hasn't even been, you know, someone who is seen, at least in terms of elite fighters, on Khabib's level at this point, because of the way Khabib just absolutely destroyed him in every conceivable way during their fight. But he's got us talking about him because he's a salesman, right? So when he does get into the ring again with elite competition, everyone's going to want to see it because of the fact that he has such a big mouth. His bravado is so large, even if he can't back it up. But he's what he's masterful at is that there's no gray areas about how you feel about Connor. You're either going to love him or you're going to dislike him so much you want to see his ass get whooped every time he gets into the ring. So another person who was masterful at doing that was Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali said he started earlier on in his career, and he based his bravado, his ability to sell fights, on a wrestler at the time. I forget the guy's name, but I think it was Gorgeous. Something Gorgeous was the wrestler's name.
And I think it was Gorgeous George.
Well, it may have been him. It may have been him. You may be right about that. But he said that when he watched that wrestler, he said that he saw the people responded to him in two ways. Either they hated him or they loved him. He said, but either way, they came to see him. And he said all he cares about was, hey, man, they're paying money to see. You can hate me, but you paying money to come there and hate me. You paying money to come there and love me. So I'm putting asses in the seats, which puts more money in my pocket, regardless of what I do or say. And that bravado, if you can back up that bravado in the ring or in the octagon, which, you know, to Connor's credit, he's been able to do in the octagon, then it justifies either the extreme dislike for him or the extreme love for him. So much so to the point where you can have a Conor McGregor step into the world of boxing and people love him so much that they will go to Vegas and pay money to see this fight and bet on him just because they honestly believe he has a shot to beat one of the best fighters that have ever lived.
Oh, if I can interrupt real quick, let me just say this. Conor McGregor's following is so massive that literally the country of Ireland will go wherever he fights. He is so well-traveled. There's no border far enough that they won't cross in order to see this guy fight. There are men, Irish men, who literally have haircuts and tattoos on their chest and arms because they love Conor McGregor.
Yes. And the loyalty he inspires from his fan base and his countrymen reminds me a lot of the loyalty somebody like Ricky Hatton inspired from his countrymen and his
excellent example
and his followers, right? So I remember when Hatton fought Floyd during the weigh-in, people were booing Floyd. That's how many people came from England to see him fight. People were booing Floyd, cheering Hatton during the fight. You could hear the British people in the crowd doing their chants, beating their drums, singing their songs. You know what I mean? That's how Europeans are. If you like look at a soccer match, it's like loud, noisy songs, music, all of these things going on in the stands. And you heard the same thing when Hatton was fighting Floyd up until Floyd knocked his little butt out. And then you ain't hear nothing no more. But that's beside the point. It was the same way with Connor. The fans, and when he comes, they have the same type of euphoria when they see him. So that's to his credit. That's to his credit. He sells the fight well, and he's able to, for the most part, back it up in the octagon. So that's to his credit. But I just feel like, for me, from my perspective, man, if you want to take shots at Khabib, dude, you need to be a lot more. I mean, I don't understand it, man. That's, you know, like, I think your analogy is absolutely right. That's like Mitch Green calling Mike Tyson a punk with a closed eye that Mike Tyson just gave him. Like, what are you doing, bro? Do you see the world as it is or as you wish it was? Like,
man, I wish I could tell you.
It doesn't make any sense, man.
You have made a couple of references to Mike Tyson. You have given some excellent boxing analogies. And so the final portion of Ground and Pound indeed involves Mike Tyson. So Mike Tyson received a lucrative offer from Bare Knuckle Fighting Championship to compete in bare knuckle boxing. In response to Mike Tyson's recent sparring videos with Frame trainer Rafael Cordeiro, Bare Knuckle Fighting Championship has reached out to Tyson, guaranteeing him $20 million for his return to action. The excitement that the whole world was getting from Tyson's training video led us to make him an offer, BKFC President David Feldman said in a statement to MMA Fighting. He's a legend, and it's just an honor to be able to talk with his team. Feldman went on to say, we will see where things go from here, but it will be an honor to work with Mike in any scenario. BKFC, should Tyson accept the offer, has offered him the option to choose his opponent from its current roster that he wants to face, which includes recent signee and former boxer Shannon Briggs. Tyson has not fought, mind you, since 2005 when he lost to Kevin McBride. That was his second consecutive defeat and third out of his last four, which ultimately led to his retirement. Now, I'm a huge fan of Mike Tyson. I love everything that Mike Tyson is doing right now. And if I can be remotely in the shape that he's in, even right now, let alone 53 years old, I would consider myself blessed. But the fact of the matter is, Mike Tyson is a 53-year-old man. And I don't like that such an invite and offer has been extended to Mike Tyson. Because to me, it comes off as if Feldman is, you know, trying to elevate his brand of combat sports at Mike Tyson's expense. I do not think a 53-year-old man should be involved in a sport where, or anything that will cause him to receive head trauma. Now, you have a relationship with Mike Tyson, or semi-personal relationship, at least, with Mike Tyson. What are your thoughts on this matter? So eager to hear what you think about
this. Let me say this, man. So, you know, I met Tyson. I spent some time around him, a few hours. I wouldn't necessarily say I have that much of a personal connection with him or say that I know him, but I did spend some time with him a few hours. And it was, I was like at the time, like 14. So I was, Mike Tyson was like,
absolutely.
Mike Tyson was like a god at that time. Right. So I was absolutely in awe of him, but to be able to sit down at a table with him and have a conversation with him was just, that was amazing to me, right? So that's probably the biggest like celebrity,
true,
like I've ever actually met, talked to, interacted with. But I don't want to say I have a personal connection with him. I don't want the MMA POV people to think that I'm saying that. But however, so let me say this: I've seen the same videos everyone else has seen about Mike hitting the mitts at 53. He looks amazing, right? His speed seems to still be there. His power certainly seems to still be there. But one very important thing that people need to understand when they watch those videos, mittens don't hit back. Mittens don't. It's a reason why people, when they hit mitts, look so good, because the person are holding the mitts still in a position where he wants the other person to hit the mitts. Nobody is going to stand in front of anyone in a boxing match, a bare knuckle fight, an MMA fight. They're not going to stand still, flat footed, and present their face as a prime target for you to hit them with all the power and speed that you have. That being said, if Mike Tyson has beef with me, I'm running away from him. And if I see him running behind me, I'm going to hit him with my car. I'm not fighting Mike Tyson, but a fighter, a person who trains for this, a person whose lifestyle is fighting, a person whose profession is combat sports. I don't see a 53-year-old Mike Tyson having gone through what he's gone through, being able to step in any ring and, you know, whoop a professional fighter of any, of course, a tomato can. Yes, he'll whoop a tomato can. Absolutely. But I'm talking about, you know, a fighter who's up on their craft, who's training, working hard. Nah, I wouldn't want to see Mike Tyson do that, because you'll see his age, you'll see his, you know, deteriorated skill immediately. Not even a guy like Shannon Briggs. I wouldn't want him to fight Shannon Briggs. I mean, Shannon Briggs is not anything great or spectacular in terms of a fighter, but, you know, I wouldn't even want that for Mike, especially bare knuckle, man, because, you know, first of all, why do people fight bare knuckle? What is this, 1890s?
Yeah, man, he just comes off. The guy just comes off Feldman. He just comes off as an opportunist to me. So now we're going to wrap up our ground and pound, and what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break. Then we're going to come back with our respective final decisions and close this thing out. This is Mixed Martial Arts Point of View Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is MMA Hall of Famer Randy the Natural Couture. Listen to Ant and Deontay on the MMA POV podcast. That's an order.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. And so we are now at the final decision. So I'm going to start things off and then I'm going to let my co-host close things out. So as mentioned earlier, UFC is having two cards this week. First Wednesday night, May 13th. UFC Fight Night Jacksonville, and then three nights later, UFC Fight Night Jacksonville. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a couple of quick stabs or jabs at the main card of the event with some quick predictions, and then I'm going to turn things over to Deontay. So for the May 13th card, looking at the main card of May 13th, my picks are as follows. In the main card opener, I'm picking Carl Robeson, although he did miss weight by 1.5 pounds. My pick is for him to beat Marvin Vettori via decision. I'm taking Rick Simon to beat Ray Borg by way of decision. I'm going with Alexander the Great Hernandez to beat Drew Dober by way of decision. I'm going with Ovince St. Preux in his heavyweight debut to beat Ben Rothwell by way of knockout. This is his debut in a heavyweight division. Usually things don't go too well for guys that are debuting in higher weight classes where they were previously. But I think Ovince St. Preux has the skill set and the mobility to beat Rothwell. And then in the main event, I'm taking Anthony Smith to beat Glover Teixeira. So just a little backstory. Smith and Teixeira, once upon a time, both faced John Bones Jones for the UFC light heavyweight championship. Both gentlemen have lost to Jones, and they are still, however, considered top tier light heavyweights in the division. So whoever comes out of this victoriously, I can't see them getting an immediate title shot, given that both Jones has beaten them both, and then you have two fighters who recently took Jones to the brink in his toughest matches of his career, that being Thiago Santos and Dominic Reyes, respectively. And not to mention Jan Blachowicz, who had an impressive outing against Corey Anderson. There is a long line in front of, or there's at least a three-person line in front of Smith and Teixeira who should get the next shot at Jones. So even whoever comes out the winner of this, I can't see them getting an immediate title shot right away, but we'll see how things go. And then moving on to the May 16th card, which will exclusively air on ESPN. By the way, the May 13th card will air on ESPN Plus. My jabs or my shots at this card go like this. Song Yadong will beat Marlon Vera by way of decision. Eric Anders will beat Christoph Jotka by way of knockout. I have Edson Barboza, who's making his featherweight division debut, to beat Dan Ige over by way of knockout, and I hope I pronounced his last name correctly. We have Clinton Maryland's own Angela Hill to beat Claudia Gadella by way of decision. And in the main event, I have Walt Harris beating Alistair Overeem. And just to give a little backstory on Walt Harris, they were supposed to fight when UFC was here in Washington, D.C. on December 28th. Unfortunately, that fight had to be postponed as a result of an unfortunate incident involving Harris's daughter, Anaya Blanchard. She was a college student in Mobile, Alabama, if I'm not mistaken, and she was kidnapped from a convenience store. And they found her vehicle, which was severely damaged, and would later find her body, or her remains, if you will. And so Walt Harris was forced out of that fight as a result of that family matter. He is now making his return to the octagon for the first time since that unfortunate incident. And if anyone who is interested, the eve of the May 16th card, ESPN Sports Center will feature I guess a documentary of sorts on Walt Harris called Fighting for Anaya. So it's going to cover all things in reference to, you know, the unfortunate murder, as well as his mission or his journey to, you know, return to what he loves to do. So that's my final decision for this episode. I now turn it over to my co-host, Deontay.
So I want to discuss the Last Dance documentary that has been airing via ESPN on Sunday evenings. It is the documentary that describes the events leading up to and, of course, the events of the final season that the storied Chicago Bulls, led by Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman, and a assortment of other cast, no, other players, not cast, but other players, what they went through to get into championship form, all the way from the time Jordan got to Chicago as a rookie through his final season with the Bulls and the 98 championship win over the Utah Jazz. So watching that documentary has allowed me to relive a certain portion of my youth, from the time I was in high school all the way through my sophomore year at Delaware State University. And I want to say two things. One, I'm in awe. As we talk about greatness within the MMA world, within the combat sports world, as we discuss greatness every show and the perseverance and the determination of the fighters, I'm in awe in the perseverance, determination, the sheer will of Michael Jordan in his pursuit of greatness, his six championships, one as the captain and leader of the Chicago Bulls, 72-10 team that went to championship and won, his many MVPs, his many finals MVPs, his many scoring titles, and without question by many NBA fans, his role, not role rather, but his title as the greatest of all time in terms of basketball players. Of course, others can make arguments for other players, but I think it's pretty much universally accepted that in terms of on the hardwood, Michael Jordan was the best we have ever seen to date. So, and reliving those moments and watching his greatness, it has, without question, given me that great emotional feeling that all sports, for sports lovers, tends to give us, right? Going back and seeing what happened behind the scenes for those seasons, how people interacted with each other, the coaching changes, the coaching staff, the general manager interacting with the team, all the ups and downs that a team goes through on a road to glory, so to speak, has been absolutely wonderful to see. But I also, that's one part of it, and I love that part of it, but there's also another part of it that I want to kind of make sure that the younger generation pays attention to, and it's an important part of it, and that is, just because a person is great at something, so great that they are better than anyone else at that thing, just because someone is so committed to something, so committed that once they reach the goal that they've been striving to reach, that no one can stop them from crossing the finish line. Just because someone is so competitive and their willpower is so strong and their discipline is so great that they can elevate themselves to be called the greatest of all time in their chosen profession, in this scenario, basketball, does not mean for the younger generation that abhorrent behavior is acceptable. One of the things that I've learned about this documentary, or learned through this documentary, is that Michael Jordan, as a person, is probably not someone that I would want to spend any time around. His pursuit of greatness, in my opinion, he used to justify his what I consider to be absolutely abhorrent behavior. The way he just seemed to bully his teammates, the way he just seemed to, and for lack of a better word, man, to be an absolute asshole. To me, I believe there is more than one way to be great. There is more than one way to exert your will, to exert or to be disciplined and focused enough to become a champion. You don't have to be a jerk, an asshole, a bully, an absolutely abhorrent person to be great at anything. And I think MJ gets a pass because of his greatness from people in terms of his behavior, in terms of like what we've seen in the documentary. So that is what I want the younger generation to take away from that. You don't have to be that way to be great. You can be a better human being to be great, right? You can be someone who speaks up where there is wrong that needs to be righted and still be the greatest of all time. You could be a dog on the court, an absolute competitor of the highest echelon, and not tell flight attendants that your teammate is not to be served dinner because they didn't have a game as good as you would have liked them to have or as good as you had. You can be a great in your sport. You can be someone to be admired in your sport without punching your teammates in the face because they're not getting something on the court, a concept or whatever, as fast as you are getting it. You can have high standards in team sports or in combat sports without actually throwing your teammate under the bus by saying they did something wrong by choosing to sit out because management was paying them as if they were one of the management wasn't paying them as if they were one of the best players while you were getting paid what you were getting paid, and then your endorsements made you one of the highest paid athletes on earth. So his behavior to me is abhorrent, not someone I would want to spend any time around, and I would hope the younger generation would see that you can be great and ascend to greatness without being that type of person. And I think that what we have seen from someone like a LeBron James, who is the person recently most often discussed as a potential GOAT, in comparison to Michael Jordan, LeBron definitely takes stances and speaks out where he sees a right that a wrong that needs to be righted. You know, I don't know if LeBron talks as much trash or is an asshole to his teammates as much as Jordan does, but from all reports, he isn't. So that's my takeaway. That's my final piece for the show, man. Thank you for allowing me to jump on the show again with you, brother. I'm having a great time and allowing me to get on my soapbox. And great show.
Well, Deontay, I got to say, man, I truly appreciate, you know, your input, especially when it comes to the final decision. You absolutely covered every aspect of Michael Jordan, who he is as an athlete on the court and from what the documentary showed us off the court. With that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we thank each and every one of you for tuning in and joining us for another episode of MMA POV Podcast. I am your host, Ant. Alongside me is
Deontay.
Once again, the show can be seen on social media, on Facebook at Wrestling POV Podcast, on Instagram and Twitter at MMA POV Podcast, and we can be heard on the streaming platforms iTunes, iHeartRadio, Podbean, and Spotify. We thank each and every one of you.
Be easy, y'all.
May you all continuously be safe, be easy, and may God continuously smile on each and every one of us. Thank you so much.